You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
This show, like all shows on Blogging Heads TV and Meaning of Life TV, is produced by the Non-Zero Foundation. Please consider supporting us financially at patreon.com/nonzerofoundation. Thanks.
Hello, Bill.
Good afternoon, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody. Bill, I'm guessing at this point you're watching the Beverly Hillbillies. You're on to something. You're past Benson. You're now into some deeper Mayberry RFD. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not a Mayberry guy. I'm still on Benson. I'm about midway through the first season of Benson. I may dust off my soap DVDs. And, cause my DVD player, you know, went kaput. I just bummed my mother's DVD player. So I may use it for soap, and I may also dust off my, remember V? The miniseries.
Oh,
V?
Yeah, about the aliens.
Yeah.
Right?
I got V and the mouse. V and V the Final Battle. I have those DVDs. I may rewatch those.
Yeah.
It doesn't get any better
80s,
than that.
That's
80s, right? That's 80s, yes.
That would be 80s, yeah.
V holds up.
I think didn't they remake it recently?
They did an ABC TV show, which was not as good. I mean, you can't reboot perfection.
So I am aware that you are a fan of Arthur Fonzarelli, and I told you about my buddy who literally moved to Mayberry.
Yeah.
But he's obviously an Andy Griffith fan, but he's also a big fan of Fonzie and Happy Days. And he got me, I think, the entire DVD collection a few years ago. And I tell you, tell me if you agree with this. Mm-hmm. I feel like the first season was really good. And then they tried to domesticate Fonzie at some point and make him like kid friendly. And I think that it really went down the drain at that point.
Well, I'd have to disagree with that. I mean, that's what made Fonzie such an icon. He was the lovable delinquent. If he was just straight delinquent the whole time, it would have been a totally different show.
No, but fair point. But he went from being a little edgy, being involved with, gang members and hoods.
Right.
Eventually he was like teaching school or something. Like he was like a teacher. It was a bit much.
You need character development. You know, he grew. You can't keep Fonzie in one place. He was too smart for that. It wouldn't have been.
I feel like you're in with the corporate suits who decided to, you know, domesticate him and make him family friendly.
You can't
make more money.
The success, the fact that people still know who Fonzie is, that Fonzie is literally one of like the American icons. I don't think it would have happened if you kept him as a two-dimensional character like that.
We disagree strongly. You know, I have a picture with the Fonzie statue, the bronze Fonz.
I did not know that.
If you ever find yourself in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, there is a bronze Fonz downtown that's super cool. By the way, you could be there for a convention. Is there going to be a convention this year?
I mean, I know Pelosi was floating a one-day in-person socially distanced convention, but I mean, not that I have any inside knowledge or anything, but I doubt it. I don't think we're anywhere near containing the virus. And so much of the Democratic messaging is follow the science, follow the rules, don't get cute with this thing. It would kind of violate that to then go have a 16,000 person event. So I think it would clash with the reality of the situation. I think it would clash with Democratic messaging. And, there's also not a ton of incentive for Democrats to really do it. I mean, what do they really get out of having an in-person TV show?
Isn't there always a convention bump?
Well, there isn't always. And look,
I mean, isn't there usually?
There usually, but it's not guaranteed. And, you know, the last convention had its moments of uncertainty. I mean, it kind of ended on a high note, but there were some unruly elements early on there will be Bernie delegates, and you can't always control who exactly the delegate is because it gets elected at the local level. It's not hand-picked from the top. So you could have disruptive moments that are not scripted, that are not great. Whereas if it's all virtual, then that's a lot easier to control and to stage manage. So
if Clint Eastwood starts talking to a chair, yeah, let's just say hypothetically, you could go to someone else. Right.
That is true.
Cut the camera.
This will probably force a huge rethink of what is the point of conventions. I mean, the convention started with, you know, the Jacksonian era of the Democratic Party that Martin Van Buren constructed.
Yeah, the Van Buren boys.
That's right.
Mean and nasty.
And you are literally deciding on the nominee at the convention. Like, that's the point of the convention, is to name the person. And that was pretty much the case up until 1972. And even 1972, with the McGovern reforms, it was still, people were still trying to contest the nominee at the convention, even though it was basically McGovern's. And you still had elements of...
As you may know, I wrote my college thesis on the McGovern convention. But for the sake of others who are not expert on it.
You're a Reagan conservative. You know what happened at the 76 convention. You know what happened at the 1980 convention.
I would recommend Reagan's Revolution by our good friend Craig Shirley to school us up on that one.
I mean, you have at several, even post-McGovern, several conventions where someone tried to challenge the presidential nominee or the vice presidential nominee was being decided at the convention.
Can I give you my favorite line from... I don't think we ever talked about this. I became pretty good friends with Lynn Nofziger. Do you know who he is?
Yeah.
I actually became, I would say, friends with him toward the end of his life. Mm-hmm. We would have breakfast. It was super cool. But the best line, the best Nofziger line from the 76 convention is, when they were trying to win it for Reagan, one of the delegates came up to Nofziger and said, you know, like, when we approach wayward delegates, what should our demeanor be? And he said, the meaner, the better. Which I thought was a pretty good line.
Sorry, Simone, my daughter is coming down. Hi, Simone.
He's laughing. What are you laughing about?
Do you want to say hi?
No.
Okay.
What are you laughing about?
You're telling me a funny story about Ronald Reagan.
That has that effect on people.
Right.
My Reagan stories tend to immediately, they will leave.
So it's really not until, I think 1984 was kind of the last time there was, you know, Gary Hart kind of tried to stop Mondale at the convention. Since 88, there's no real business going on there.
There was a thought that they would attempt to stop Trump.
Barely. I mean, he had the delegates. Cruz didn't endorse him then, but there was no real game afoot to actually stop the nomination.
Was an attempt. I don't remember Ken Cuccinelli was trying to leading some. They had an argument that they could demand some roll call vote or something.
Yeah, but this is pretty, last ditch, not very serious, and. You get the occasional platform vote on the floor, but the premise of conventions has outlived its usefulness with the full development of a primary system. So it stands to reason that if having an in-person convention becomes too dangerous, that it prompts a rethink. Why are we even doing these things anymore? They're literally, I mean, and I like conventions. I'm not the kind of guy who hates on tradition. I like tradition. But it's just an objective fact that they don't do what they were built to do in the first place.
And Liz, who is I'm blanking on her last name, Pete Buttigieg campaign manager,
Liz Smith.
Smith, okay. I was going to say that, and then I was like, it can't be Smith. She wrote a piece basically making this case, right?
Yeah. And she's not alone there. I've seen it from other people too. But she was saying, take advantage of it being a virtual convention and repurpose it for modern times. And I think that's absolutely, absolutely right. I would not be surprised if going forward, people say, this is a lot of effort, a lot of expense. I mean, part of it is 'cause it's fun. It's a party. People like going to parties, and I'm sympathetic to a good party. But it's a lot of effort, a lot of expense, a lot of heavy lifting for a temporary bump that usually goes away.
Yeah. Well, there's always a sense that you have to do it, and now there's an excuse not to do it. What if, I mean, presumably Trump is going to do his convention. Maybe it'll be scaled down, but presumably Trump is going to do something. And I mean, Trump does it and Biden doesn't, is that like unilateral disarmament?
I don't think so. Of course, the governor and the mayor, the governor of North Carolina and the mayor of Charlotte are Democrats. And they could either for scientific reasons or for mischievous reasons say you can't have this convention. That we're not allowing in-person events in our state and in this city. So that's a little bit of a wild card, but you would assume Trump's message is we have to reopen. So it very much conflict with his message for the Republican Party to cancel the convention. And if you have the convention, who shows up are the people that say, that's great, having the convention, I'm gonna take it from home. Is it an empty room?
It actually does seem, I mean, anyone who's ever been to a convention, it seems like a really bad idea. I mean, of all the things you could do, like, I mean, they're packed in on the floor and it's crowded. You take a city that's already pretty big and you bring in thousands of new people, and not just the convention center is packed, and you want it to look packed, like for camera optics, but just, I mean, hotels are booked, flights are booked. I mean, it's just on every level, it seems like a bad idea for a pandemic.
I mean, to have a socially distanced convention is probably not all that protective public health wise. And it's also optically terrible. It's not the packed room. It's not the signs waving. There's no energy in the room. Everyone's 6 feet apart. So what do you really get
Obama
out of
that? Obama did like a stadium, right, in yeah. Charlotte, I think.
Oh, that was – Denver was the first one, Denver. 2008.
Maybe that's the model.
Because I was at those. I think there was talk of a stadium event in Charlotte in 2012, and then they didn't do it, if I remember correctly.
Well, was there a weather problem?
Yeah,
they moved it inside.
That sounds right. That sounds right. But I was at the stadium in Denver, and
that would be a potential an outdoor event.
But even still, you're in the crowd. It's still a crowded in stands, and if everyone's 6 feet apart, that's not a very good. There's not a lot of energy in that stadium if that's the way it is. It looks like a, you know, Chicago Cubs game.
I don't know about you, but I've been having a hard time watching. Like, I don't know if you saw the Parks and Recreation special.
I did.
That was pretty good.
Yeah.
But watching like Bill Maher and SNL when they don't have the laugh track there's no laugh track and there's no live audience.
Yeah.
It's different, man. And I think in a debate scenario, if assuming that Biden and Trump debate, if there's no audience, that's going to hurt Trump.
For a debate?
He feeds off the crowd so much. And he'll say something funny. If there's no one there to laugh, it's not going to have the same effect. That's my take anyway.
I still remember the debates with Hillary having a great crowd response. I mean, I'd have to go back and watch again, but I thought it was a fairly restrained crowd for those debates because I think they were kind of instructed not to be raucous.
They're instructed, but Trump says things that are so outlandish that there's actually a visceral laughter response that is very difficult to contain, and I think he feeds off of it.
So I had a piece in Politico, if I may segue, about Biden's online efforts, which have been criticized in many corners, most prominently by David Axelrod and David Plouffe in a New York Times op-ed. And since he is stuck at home and so much of the campaign is virtual now, the argument has been like he can't afford to have this be a low rent operation. He can't afford technical glitches. He can't afford a lack of creativity because this is the campaign, and even in even if there wasn't a pandemic, so much of campaign activity is virtual now. Trump is a master of these mediums. David Weigel at the Washington Post did a column where he gets the Trump app and the Biden app and signs up for the notifications and and shares what the experience is like. And the Trump experience is constant bombardment, pushing your outrage buttons, getting you involved and energized and angry. And
there's also gamification, if that's the right term. Mm-hmm. You can earn points. I don't know if this is in the Dave Weigel piece, but I read this in the New York Times. You can like get points, and if you get like 50,000 points, you can get a photo with Trump. So it's playing on our, you know, it's pushing our buttons.
And you know, when Weigel was on the Biden app, it was, you know, it took several hours to get a response. It's very genial message about pulling together and soul of America, but it's not this constant bombardment. And it's not trying to make you angry. It's trying to make you feel good about America and good about the campaign. And it's just a whole different vibe. And it's not really what works in the digital space. But my argument in the piece was, so what? That's what did we learn from Super Tuesday? Biden was not killing it on online media. Bernie was. And that had direct impact to Bernie's whole ground game operation, volunteer army, small donors, field offices, and the like. Michael Bloomberg had all the paid media. You couldn't hide from Bloomberg advertising. Biden was broke. Biden had no field offices. Biden wasn't even visiting a lot of states. But his free media was absolute gold for 72 hours. And that made all the difference in the world. And that's like a poli-sci experiment, you know, executed in front of your eyes. What's the most important thing? If you're winning free media, nothing else matters. And the other things matter in closer races. You know, if the electorate is fairly evenly divided, all the little things can matter. And I'm not saying that this can't be a close race, because it certainly can. But the first thing you want to do, if at all possible, is just win the argument. Win the argument with the public. Have that message clearly communicated in the media. If you have that, everything else is secondary. And Biden can win the argument without being the master of TikTok.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. And in fact, part of his brand is not being sophisticated. It's part of what makes him likable.
Well, I mean, but a good digital team would, you know, take your candidate's brand and persona and make that work for their operations, which I think they're trying to do. But he does have his personality is not as conducive. I mean, online media is a niche thing. You're trying to play niches. It's not being broadly appealing. You're trying to juice your base and depress the other person's base with negative messages about that side's candidate.
Sure.
And
well, you know what's going to juice Biden's base, and there are two things. One is Trump,
right?
And the other is, in my opinion, Trump has made a huge mistake. Have you seen this thing, Bill, that they call Obamagate?
I've heard of Obamagate. I fear we're going to be talking about Obamagate ad nauseum now.
I am of the opinion that this is great news for Joe Biden. I don't get why Trump is doing this. I mean, think of it. There's one person that when he's on the ballot, we know without a shadow of a doubt, he can excite not just people who hate the opponent, but people who love him. People, and especially African-American turnout and enthusiasm, and that's Barack Obama. Donald Trump is giving Joe Biden the ability to plausibly run ads that say, if Donald Trump wins re-election, he's going to try to lock him up. He's gonna come after Barack Obama. I mean, that sounds like a crazy idea, but Trump is essentially playing into that argument. So I guess this is a long way of saying I think you're onto something. This isn't, you know, Biden doesn't necessarily need the most sophisticated tech operation to excite and turn out supporters, because they're going to be turned out by Donald Trump, and I think he's playing into that.
Well, I mean, what I think is happening with Obamagate is it's a replay of Burisma. Try to gin up the notion that there's something afoul that happened or is happening with Obama, Biden, deep state, that goes back to 2016 and continues on. Regardless of whatever basis that it has, you make it a news story, you put Biden on the defensive, he's constantly being asked about it, he's being asked to prove this and disprove that, and at minimum, Biden's not talking about what he wants to talk about. Talking about this, you know, you're not talking about Trump's failings on the pandemic, you're not talking about economic solutions to a depression, you're talking about this nonsense scandal. It is a play that Trump is very comfortable running. Ran it against Hillary, ran it during the primary, it's something that was going to happen in some form, no matter who the nominee was, because that's the way Trump does things.
Maybe I'll be proven wrong, but Barack Obama is incredibly well liked. He is widely popular. He is an historic figure. He's a very likable person. And I think he's done a lot of bad stuff, but you just have to, you know, give him props for just being a charismatic, likable, transformational political figure. He's not Hillary Clinton. You can't do this to him. He's not Joe Biden. This is Barack Obama.
Well, Joe Biden's not Hillary Clinton either.
I think it's a big mistake to pick a fight with Barack Obama. And not just to pick a fight with him, but to insinuate that you want to prosecute him and his administration. Them's fighting words. I think that this is going to come back to haunt them.
I mean, if you're bringing Obama sort of onto the playing field, where at some point Obama does an interview and responds to it in a very, you know, this is utterly ridiculous kind of way, which I think Obama can deliver that tone very well. It's sort of very common sense, like, you know, sort of, come on, this is nonsense. To the extent you're making him a player in this game again, yeah, I think that's not good for Trump. But I generally agree with you. I would add to that by saying, look, Burisma didn't work at the end of the day. I think it did complicate matters for Biden for a time. His numbers did go down in December and January, both in the primary and in the trial heats with Trump, but they didn't go through the floor, and it was very much double-edged for Trump, getting impeached and all. And so it wasn't the kill shot that Trump wanted it to be.
Right, and likewise, I would say, good luck turning Michael Flynn into a lovable victim.
I mean, that is very weird about all this. Of all the threads you want to pull, why do you want to pull this one?
Exactly. I'm willing to believe that. I mean, I've got problems with the FBI, sort of the way that they seem to have set him up, and like I'm a little bit uncomfortable with that. All that being said, Michael Flynn is is not some cuddly, innocent little, you know, victim here, and so. I don't get it. I don't think this makes a lot of sense.
I'm curious how this germinated. Will we ever get the story of like who made the decision to say, here's what we do. We bring back Michael Flynn.
No, I'd have to go back and research this, but I feel like this bubbled up from like cable news or the Twittersphere or something. And Trump then was like, oh, yeah, yeah, this is, you know. And then, you know, Rick Grenell, who's the Intel head acting, has, I guess, responded to the Senate requests to name people who were involved in the unmasking of people who were, people who were surveilled during the transition period. But I feel my take is that Trump didn't. My sense here is that Trump didn't mastermind this, but that, like, he just saw an opportunity. Oh, what a great branding name, Obamagate. That's a great hashtag. Let's go with that.
But the series of events that led to the DOJ trying to drop the case against Flynn, I mean, that's not something that just sort of magically happened. Someone in the administration made a decision to resurrect this case and try to make it into... not just to keep Flynn out of jail, but to have a narrative that he was wronged by the deep state of the FBI, who were tied to the Obama and by the administration, and now trying to extend that into this unmasking episode where Biden knew that the FBI was looking into Flynn, which is kind of like, yeah. So when they got briefed on
this, strikes me as it's a niche move. I mean, I think this excites and motivates Trump's base, just like everything Trump does excites and motivates his base. You can excite the hell out of them. They're going to turn out. They love him. But they're like 42% or something, right? I mean, I don't think this plays in Peoria. I don't think this plays to anybody else at all. In fact, I think this let's go back to what we were talking about with the tech campaign and the worries about it, about energizing Biden's base, about Biden being able to energize people. I mean, Trump is doing that job for him. And specifically, Hillary had a problem getting – if Hillary had the same turnout of African Americans as Obama did, she would have been president. I'm pretty sure that that's accurate, right?
So close. There's so many little things you could point to.
I'm sure a lot of factors, but that was one of the things she couldn't replicate. I think it's – I don't know why you would make this move.
Well, I mean, I basically agree. I think the fundamentals of this race very much tip towards Biden. I think the lead Biden has had over Trump has been very stable. And it's pretty hard to distract the public away from a calamitous pandemic and economic depression, which – I am very skeptical we're going to be close to recovered from by the fall. So this all smacks of desperation tactics that I don't think the average person would be snookered by. Having said all that, I think Biden, and not that I think Biden's being naive here in any way, because this whole campaign has been one attempt to gin up scandal after another, and the way Trump has kept his opponents off kilter ever since he became a candidate was constant, brutal negativity in a fashion that that free media can't look away from and forces you to ditch your preferred game plan to then play on Donald Trump's turf, which is tricky. And so even though I agree with you that there are so many elements here that don't play to Trump's favor, it still has a good chance of forcing Biden to not talk about the things he wants to talk about and having to respond to Trump. And this is after, you know, a couple months of Burisma and a month of Tara Reid, and now it's Obamagate.
If Biden's team doesn't let every African-American in America know Donald Trump wants to put Barack Obama and his administration in jail, then they should be sued for malpractice. Okay? He's handing it to him on a silver platter. And so that's check one. Check two, I don't think that this thing works on Biden. I mean, maybe he's Inspector Clouseau when he's a just stumbling, you know, ambling toward 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. But things don't seem – it feels like Obama's – I mean, not Obama. Biden is, like, oblivious to these attacks. Like,
you know,
like
piece,
he's just – oh, I didn't – I had a oh, piece
in,
that.
Real clear a couple weeks ago, is Biden in trouble or is he Teflon? There's a decent argument that he's Teflon at this point. You know, I still want to see a few more polls. You know, there's a little
well,
bit
because
of –
he's. Because he, well, he has 100% name ID.
Yeah.
He's got a built-in brand of being bumbling and gaffe-prone, and but, that he owns that. But, and he's able to hide. He's in his basement.
Well, but I think bumbling and gaffe-prone is oversimplifying. I mean, that's sort of like the most negative element of the standard persona, but also very decent and very, very, very common sense. And very empathetic. So there's a lot to the basic Biden.
He's like
brand.
Your uncle.
Yeah.
Uncle
yeah.
Joe.
And,
right?
You know,
he's
going to
say some things at Thanksgiving that are uncomfortable and politically incorrect, but deep down, you know, Uncle Joe's a good person.
Right.
And he's always been there, and God love him, at the end of the day, he's going to do his best. Right?
Right. I mean, Trump had the advantage of being able to exploit 20 years of negative narratives placed on Hillary Clinton by the Republican Party and the conservative movement. And he just, you know, jacked it up, you know, several notches. You're starting kind of from scratch with Biden to make him out to be an ogre.
Right.
And granted, you had some help from some Bernie Bitterenders out there. But by and large, I mean, look, Biden just put together this unity policy committee that spans from, you know, AOC to John Kerry. The vast majority of the Democratic Party is rallying behind Biden. You're not able to easily create a brand new persona of a bumbling rapist who is running the deep state. I think that is hard to put together. While it's very easy to retort, how many times does Donald Trump have to manufacture a scandal to distract from his colossal failures, which are staring in front of the face?
I mean, it's just not plausible that Biden is behind the deep state. I mean, it's just not. But Bill, have you seen this poll? I think this speaks to something you were getting at. I saw a poll somewhere that was stunning, and it said there's like a whole lot of people who essentially hate Biden and Trump, but 70% of them would vote for Biden. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
right.
You can put that in, you could rephrase that in more accurate terms, I think.
Well, there's, you know, Trump won the people who hated both candidates last time. Now, even though Trump's unfavorables were worse than Hillary's, but he still won the pool of voters who found them both unfavorable. And that was a big part of the difference. Right now, Biden's winning those voters, which stands to reason. You know, it is very typical for a reelection campaign to be a referendum on the incumbent. If you don't like the incumbent, you don't care about the other guy. You'll take the new guy if you hate the old guy. So we are already seeing Biden lead almost every national poll. There's one out there that's a tie. CNN today was 5 points. You know, there are a couple of 3-pointers out there. Monmouth was 9 points. The vast majority of swing state polls are in Biden's favor. There's even a Georgia poll where it's very tight. There's Texas that's tied, but Arizona, North Carolina, he's ahead. Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, he's ahead. There was even a Democratic internal poll that came out last night that had Biden up by 11 points in the second congressional district of Nebraska, which has one electoral vote. Now, Democratic internal poll, I'm not saying take it to the bank or anything, but even if that's off 5 points, Biden's still winning it. It's just something to keep an eye on. I'd like to see more objective polling from there. But this is just one data point in many.
But that can make the difference. I mean, that one electoral
there
vote
are scenarios.
Could,
there are scenarios where it could be a 270-268 campaign with that district being the determining factor. But there's a whole trend of swing states going Biden's way. And you know, there's a question, should I trust these national polls? If Biden's only 3, 4, 5 points ahead in the national polling, that doesn't make me feel confident because he could lose the Electoral College. But while that is happening, he's winning these states too in the polls. Now, the polls could be wrong. I'm not saying this is dead certainty. But there's a lot of evidence that Biden's demographics are not Hillary's demographics. So you can't look at the fact that Hillary had a relatively okay popular vote lead at the end of the day. I think it was 2 points.
Yeah.
And she couldn't win Electoral College. Well, if he's winning more seniors than she is, then he is doing better in Florida and better in Arizona. And it's not going to be, if he's doing better with whites.
Old people are going for Biden, right?
They're going for Biden very consistently in most polls. Trump's approval with seniors is down. And with that is increased support from white voters. So it's not the same cultural divide that 2016 was, which makes it harder for Trump to pull off the popular vote loss Electoral College win.
Indeed. Any chance that Michelle Obama joins the ticket, Bill?
Hold on 1 second here. I just want to show off a cat.
Oh, what's is that, Mr. Jiggles?
What's that? That's
Mr.
Sparky.
Jiggles.
That's Sparky.
Sparky.
Sparky is 4
Jingles.
Months old.
Mr. Jingles. That was, Mr. Jingles was the Meet the Parents cat, right?
What's that?
Mr. Jingles was the Meet the Parents cat.
That's right. We got another cat. Another cat coming in.
We have two boys.
All right. Well, while we're taking this cat nap, let me throw this one out to you. We lost a legend this week, Bill.
Yeah.
We lost Jerry Stiller.
Yes.
We have two boy kitties. Their names are Mochi and Sparky, and they're both 2 months old, and they're both very cute.
They're 4 months old.
4 months old?
They are
really?
Cute.
They're all almost 4 months. So there you go. Yes, we did lose Jerry Stiller.
We lost Jerry Stiller, and my friend Rich from Mayberry and I got into a pretty heated back and forth about Jerry Van Dyke versus Jerry Stiller. Is it Jerry Van Dyke? Was that the brother Luther from Coach?
Oh, from Coach. Oh, I wasn't a big Coach fan, but I think you're right.
Oh, okay. Well, we got into an argument, and my friend argues that Van Dyke was the better. There's a lot of similarities with those two actors.
I have a hard time believing that anything involving Coach was better than Seinfeld. Not that I'm like the biggest Seinfeld fan, but I am decidedly not a big Coach fan.
Yeah. So, well, okay, but what you may not know is that Van Dyke, Dick Van Dyke's brother, I think it was Jerry, was also on Andy Griffith at the end. After Barney left, after Warren left, we got him.
Your friend from Mayberry's got some serious Mayberry bias, so I'm not sure I'm going to
him
for my cultural critiques. But there are some Jerry Stiller
even
scenes.
The King of Queens, where Stiller is in The King of Queens. I put that ahead of Coach, by a hair.
There are certain. I mean, Seinfeld can be a little overhyped. Not every episode is, perfection. But there are certain Jerry Stiller scenes which are really exceptional. The Jay Buhner, George Steinbrenner scene is perfect.
That's when he meets Steinbrenner, his son's boss, and all he can do is complain about a trade, right?
Right. Oh no. Steinbrenner tells him that George died.
Oh, that's it.
He said George has died,
and he's like, "How could you trade him?
How could you trade Jay Buhner?" and that was perfect. People go back to Festivus. I gotta say, I think Festivus was the concept of Festivus is excellent. I thought the scene was not as good as it could have been. I always feel a little let down by that scene because he starts into the grievances.
Yeah, and the earring.
And he loses his chain of thought. You don't get very many grievances. Like, I wanted more grievances. I thought that was a missed opportunity.
That would have been, I think it'd be funny to hear all the things that throughout the year that they've done that bothered him.
Yeah.
Would have been good. So I would recommend his New York Times obituary is worth reading. And at the end, I don't know if you saw it, Bill. It's actually funny. They made it funny and touching at the end.
It's an exceptional career.
He will be missed. He will be missed, as will Luther from Coach, also missed. And Dauber. Dauber's still with us.
And okay. Clayton from Benson, who's also not with us anymore, as well as Benson.
They will.
Are there political things we should talk about before we sign off?
What was I saying before we met Mr. Jingles? Do you remember?
We're talking about Biden and the Electoral College and his demographics.
I think we've kind of covered it.
I think there are other things you want to talk about today, though.
I don't think so. I mean, look, people who come here, they're just consistently getting their money's worth. We were cited, by the way, by Bob Wright on a recent episode of their pandemic show with Mickey Kals. They referenced us. So we're just, you know, consistently getting the job done. a lot of comments about our Benson commentary I saw.
One thing we haven't talked
people
about.
People love that.
We have not talked about the Kamala buzz.
Oh, well, I asked you about Michelle Obama.
Oh, that's right. That's where we got off track.
Any chance?
That's right. No chance for Michelle. It's utterly ridiculous. It's total fanfic. If she was actually picked, which would never happen, if she actually was, it would be terrible. She would be destroyed.
What?
She would be destroyed. She's golden now. It would be mocked as an unserious pick, unqualified, Barack behind the throne, Biden can't win this by himself. It would just be a total disaster.
Those things would be said, and then they would win 80% of the vote.
I disagree. I think think it is very important that Biden do a serious pick, someone who is unquestionably prepared to be president on day one, and does nothing to a do no harm candidate. I'm not saying they can't have positives, but number one rule: do no harm. Michelle creates a narrative that is potentially very damaging, that Biden can't do this job by himself and Barack's going to run the show.
Right. I'll buy into the do no harm thing, although I will just say Tim Kaine was a do no harm pick.
Well, I mean, I will argue to the hill I will die on is that Clinton should have picked Al Franken. I will die on that hill. But you can't say she lost because of Tim Kaine. I mean, Tim Kaine did his job in not being a distraction and allowing the top of the ticket to be in control of his or her destiny. So I don't blame Kaine for
So I say Amy Klobuchar is going to be the pick and should be the pick.
You still say that. You're sticking with that.
I still think she should be. Okay. In terms of what will happen, I think I'm starting to come to the Kamala conclusion.
This was the first week of real reporting around the possibility that it's going to be Kamala. You had a Politico story. You had a Time story. It's very clear that there are a lot of Kamala promoters in the upper echelons of the Democratic Party, in the Biden inner circle. I think the negative arguments against her were clearly not deterring those folks from making a very active push for her. I made the case early on. She was number one in my political ranking, which was not a prediction. It was an argument. And I further made the case in Real Clear Politics that she's the do no harm candidate. Klobuchar has a chorus of opponents on the left. Warren has a chorus of opponents amongst Democratic business-friendly donors. Whitmer doesn't have Democratic attackers necessarily, though there's some people that don't want a white Midwesterner.
I think she'd be a disaster. That's where I'm out of touch with conventional
business. She's ginned up a lot of negativity at home, which I think makes her a complicated pick for someone who's supposed to be able to carry her state easily. There is no faction that is deeply opposed to Kamala Harris. No one's going to be, oh, man, I can't believe you did that. Oh, you blew this one. You know, I don't think anyone's going to be saying that if she's picked.
Well, let me throw one thing out. And by the way, are there, like, flashes going off or police lights? I see, like, some, like, bright flashes every once in a while.
I think it's the sun and the cars driving by. I mean,
I don't know if it's, is it the pop, maybe it's the paparazzi. They know we're taping.
I mean, we do get more sirens these days than we used to, but I'm not seeing sirens right now.
Believe me. No, here's my one pushback to that. And it's sort of a caveat. All these, Lincoln, project people who are backing Republicans for Biden, and there's going to be apparently there's in the works a Republicans for Biden campaign. They're doing this at a time when Biden is accused of sexual assault. They're doing this at a time when Biden has gone up against Betsy DeVos's policies regarding due process for sexual harassment and sexual assault allegations on college campuses. They're doing this at a time when Biden's or people in Biden's camp are talking about him being the next FDR. If you pick Kamala Harris, doesn't it become even harder to be a Republican for Biden knowing that Kamala Harris is going to be the heir apparent of Joe Biden as opposed to Amy Klobuchar?
Kamala is not a swing vote pick. She's not there to attract the swing voter. She's more there to maintain and augment Democratic Party unity. Biden is the candidate that's there to get the swing voter. That's his job. I don't think.
So you're saying she balances the ticket, and I'm saying, going to the Bill Clinton Al Gore model, you double down on your brand.
Klobuchar's a double down. I agree with that. Double down's a risky pick. You know, I mean, Bill Clinton pulled it off, but there are downsides to that strategy too. I think Kamala is a mild balance pick. It's not a desperation balance pick like a Warren would be. Warren, I think, would be much more alienating to that potential Republican for Biden. I don't think the Republican for Biden or independent for Biden is going to be, I was going to do it, but with Kamala, forget it. I don't think she's a deal breaker.
I'm just thinking about Republicans who are going to try at some point to come back to the Republican Party or the conservative movement ostensibly after having supported President, you know, somehow President Kamala becoming, you know, and all sorts of other compromises that they made along the way. I just wonder how that's going to be.
Well, if that person's mindset is, I'm just doing this for 2020. I'm back in the fold 2024. If Republicans get their act together, who cares the VP is then? You know, you're not going to be like, well, you're not worried where the Democratic Party goes from there. You're not planning to stick around.
Well, I think you have some, should I say blood on your hands? Maybe that's not the right term, but some culpability if you elevated this guy. But anyway, look, I will say this. Kamala has the potential to turn on the charm. I mean, she can become a very likable, moderate person. She just chose not to run that way. And so I'll never forget that the way she, you know, behaved in like the Kavanaugh hearings and all that stuff, and the way she campaigned when she attacked Joe Biden on school bus.
If she's very charming, you absolutely will forget those things. That's the thing about being a politician.
But people will. Other people.
I don't
will.
Think those things are burning people's memories. I mean, how many Republicans continue to blame George H.W. Bush for voodoo economics? I mean, that was a pretty cutting thing to say in the primary.
I think I've forgotten that, Bill.
He became president.
That gets brought up.
President of the United States.
I'm just saying.
Beat Bob Dole.
In the circles that I travel in, they never really trusted George H.W. Bush.
They trusted him enough to become president of the United States.
So, one time.
Well, one's enough. So, I mean, I think the people who are most down on Kamala argue.
And by the way, let me say, I've come to respect George H.W. Bush's presidency much more in hindsight.
Fair enough. The people very negative on Kamala amongst Democrats generally argue, well, she was a bust as a candidate. She did not do very well. She didn't attract African-American support. She didn't have a clear, coherent message. Why would you assume she'd have any ability to juice the electorate as VP. And I think that is a very simplistic way to look at it. I mean, if you're going to the pool of former candidates, they all lost, so no one was awesome. Joe Biden wasn't awesome in 2008, but they were flashes. There were sort of moments in 2008 where you were like, oh yeah, there's something I like about that guy. So you didn't judge him on the fact that he didn't launch in Iowa. You still credit him for what positive attributes that he had. You understand the mistakes that Kamala made. The mistake she made was she ran more to the left than where she naturally is and couldn't find room there with Bernie and Elizabeth in her way. And then swinging back towards the middle was too late. And, I mean, she didn't win black votes, not because black votes hate her. She didn't win black votes because they really like Joe Biden. So that's not really a negative commentary on her. I mean, she tried.
Do we know how African Americans feel about her? We don't really know that, do we? I'd be curious to see.
I mean, you might want to explore that.
Was she
more.
Their second choice?
I think there is. I think there was polling that did say that. Maybe others that had Bernie second because he was getting a lot of young voters. It might depend on the poll or the state or what have you. But the mistakes she made are not mistakes that she is what would be likely to replicate as a VP candidate whose job it is to echo Biden's message. She's not going to be confusing about her message when she's being a good loyal soldier and following the boss's script.
All right, so what are the odds that it's either Amy or Kamala?
On the presumption...
Is that 90% likely?
On the presumption that there are no vetting issues with either. I mean, I think the four that are being most seriously considered are Harris, Klobuchar, Whitmer, Warren. And the fifth, possibly Cortez Masto, although there's some report that maybe she doesn't really want the job, but Reed was pushing her.
I think Whitmer and Warren are both huge mistakes, or at least very risky.
My guess is that even though there's a lot of reporting that Warren is being seriously considered, and there are people in Biden's circle that think she is the ideologically unifying ticket, I would be really, really shocked if Biden was giving her serious consideration.
Could she be happy with the attorney general job?
If I'm Warren, I am totally gunning for attorney general. That's a job with real power. That's what I'd be doing.
It's not just going to funerals for 4 years.
She gets to lock people up. I mean, that's what she should be doing.
And Trump better be careful, by the way, of floating this idea of retribution against the past administration. I think that's a very dangerous idea. I used to go on MSNBC all the time in 2008 and go up against progressives who wanted to jail Bush administration officials for war crimes. And I thought it was a bad idea back then for the same reason.
Well, Biden's already talking about going over how the pandemic bailout money has been spent and prosecuting people who did corrupt things with it. So he might actually go there.
Well, look, I mean, if there are, you know, businesses and stuff who are price gouging or whatever, I mean, that's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But going after an administration for decisions that they made or people who were following, dare say, orders, Bill. I think it's banana republic stuff. It's a slippery slope, and it takes its places I don't really like.
Well, be that as it may, I think that Warren is, to the extent that weaknesses were shown in the primary, I think Warren's weaknesses have more general election downside than Harris's weaknesses. Warren is someone who never could convince folks that she could be seen as appealing to swing voters. Like, Harris never had a swing voter issue in the primary. Warren did.
Warren's like 70 some years old too, right? I mean, it's just...
I mean, I think a younger pick probably makes more sense.
Yeah.
But I just don't think Biden wants to have an ideologically disparate ticket. I think he's willing to have some level of disagreement, but there are degrees and Warren is probably a bridge too far for him. He was reported that he looks at as who's good in July, who's good in October, who's good in January, who's good for the initial shot of publicity, who's good on election day, who's good for governing. And I don't think Warren is good on October or January from Biden's perspective.
Yeah.
So, Klobuchar may well be in that top two as a safer choice than a Whitmer or Warren, but you haven't seen as much Klobuchar chatter as of late because there isn't, I think, a big enthusiastic choir for her in the mainstream of the Democratic Party.
What's the name that Trump calls Warren? It's not Sacagawea. What is it?
If you've forgotten that, you're definitely going to forget what Harris did in the Kavanaugh hearings.
Well, whatever.
Pocahontas.
What is the name?
Pocahontas.
Okay. So there's some Pocahontas pack. And I think it's like I have to look it up, but I think it's like I assume it's an anti-Elizabeth Warren pack or something. Anyway, there's a Matt Lewis who's their treasurer. The reason I know this is it's not me. If anyone wants to know, the Matt Lewis of the anti-Pocahontas PAC treasurer is not me.
So you say.
The people against Pocahontas or something. I assume it's an anti-Elizabeth Warren PAC. It must be in Massachusetts. It's not me. It's one of the other billion Matt Lewis's. Bill, we need to plug something.
Okay.
You and me doing this live Friday, 4 p.m. tentatively on Zoom.
Yeah, we've done a bunch of Zooms, but the Friday 4 p.m. slot seems the most popular slot. That's the
get your weekend a big turnout.
We did. So it's good times. Bring a drink. Man, I didn't have a drink last time, you know, and I don't drink, but I'll have something with me. Maybe I'll make one of my egg creams for Friday at 4. It's 4 o'clock Eastern, by the way.
You should totally do it.
4 o'clock Eastern time. We have a global audience. We literally have people from the opposite side of the world on these calls.
Yeah, we got a dude from London. Where else? Do you remember?
We had London and we had, I think it was Bulgaria.
Oh, yeah. It's fun. It's great meeting fans of the DMZ. How could people get on that Zoom call, Bill, if they were so inclined?
This is where, it's a steep ask. You have to become a Patreon supporter of one of us.
Yes.
Matt collects funds to help with his newsletter and his podcast, and I'm putting together the history podcast whenever I get a moment of peace in this household to do some recording. I try to do so. I'm trying to refine my pilot episode as we speak. Your money does go somewhere to produce real content that you will enjoy.
That's right. And it's patreon.com/BillShare.
Yes. And yours is Matt Lewis or Matt K. Lewis?
Just Matt Lewis. So check it out. We'd love to see you. We'd love to meet you. And I've met people never met before, been listening to us for a decade. Some repeat, business, where we're kind of getting to know people by now and get, making friends. It's fun. So check it out.
So hope to see you on Friday.
Yeah, we've got 2 days, so there hopefully will be new. One time we did it, I think it was 2 weeks ago, or the Zoom call and the DMZ were essentially back, like the same show, the same topics. But usually we let a couple days, we have different topics, so it's fun.
But that's not so negative here. Even if we're doing the same topic, you're getting a different perspective, and you're getting in on the conversation as well. So I don't think it's...
That's true.
I don't think it's just hearing the same show twice.
You and I will talk for like 15 or 20 minutes and then we throw it open and it's like I had to go after like an hour and 10 minutes last week. So I think we were pushing an hour and 10 minutes at least by the time all was said and done. So good stuff. Bill Scher, always a pleasure.
Same here. I'll talk to you on Friday and next week in the DMZ.
Got it. Thanks.
Bye.